Okay. Hello, welcome to LA Lit's 1 year anniversary. This is kind of a reading of various people that have been on LA Lit in the past. And we're really happy to have you here.
Yeah, welcome.
And we're going to start off, Stephanie and I, when we first started talking about LA Lit, we also had a kind of collaborative poetry blog, which is still up. It's out in the world, although we haven't looked at it, I think, for several months, but it's called traditionalx.blogspot.com. And just to get the night started, we're going to read a poem that we wrote on that blog. So here we go. Pegasus emotion sank brittle, bloodied. Flying, hoofing to stain root, ghost must move uneven. Slink around carrion, feathered foot.
Jaw detached, melted in Euphrates, water released a deer, a lute. Curving plant shake arm, slake thirst of bank, molten wood.
Stand wrapped, break pencil, nerve writhe in sheets, ease cap rip winkle, making motor, repeat.
Bombs in cracked candy flame, mistaken in tin car, stick, drive it today, tank bent to shape your bed, but gas repels your teddy, take it away.
The first limb sly, under wrist, unmixable, ascending crane to brain, the cap, catnecks, tear of fleas, blur of freak accident, harm of desk, crack.
Canyon of cry chopped morning, lit same drain, tar, gum, crayon, peeled jelly of molasses day, record of fin wall fissure, sight mud through vision.
Least tractor of left troops, burns a moot, uniform on famous nude Danny boy, slurp vita wheat of skin slow in Kansas, cover Canada, roll blank spots, uniform.
Leave glasses on sidewalk, pop pox off torn cat stare on fake bird, slap fanny over Hollywood, cast stuck in dentist talent, skeleton cockspur, record.
Willow thinks dome colors fission, maliciously simple in nuclear shell. China dig oxidant holdings, fax ton snakes hats, harebell.
Leave it tomorrow, tink tinkerer, perichin wood nail, mores, moss. Pegasus emotion sank brittle. Moodily, my maker barks.
All right. So we'd like to invite Anthony McCann to come up here. Anthony McCann is a recent addition to the Los Angeles kind of poetry scene, and we're really happy to have him here, and we're happy that we got to interview him before he got officially to Los Angeles. So welcome, Anthony.
All right, thanks, guys. First poem is called Jack. And it seems now to address our retarded immigration crisis, or so it's called. Jack, which is not his real name, was concerned about the progress of his recovery. The rest of us couldn't understand because we were immigrants, not entirely legal, and besides, we stood outside the doors of that facility, exporting rain and comparing rocks. Jack is a large American man of a typical brand. He is like a helicopter, or he is like an amphibious assault vehicle. His entire body is covered in hair. His arms, his hands, with which he is always touching me. Jack's eyes are small and dry, which is surprising considering the enormity and moisture of his apparent need. Excuse me. What Jack hopes to recover, I do not understand. He is always looking me in the eyes with those eyes, or if not, he is always looking away as if toward the mountains which do not exist in this country. The land here is scarred and flat and faintly evil, and I still cannot accurately pronounce its name. No one here can pronounce my name, so I too am called Jack. And this is my relationship with Jesus. Yes. I have a standard joke now I make with this poem. I'm going to make it again. It's shameless. Which is, Jesus and I, we used to be really close. till I caught him cheating on me with you people. I can't make that joke anymore. It's third time I've done it. I am looking at the sky, which is blue and empty, and thinking of his lips, which are closed and dry. Or standing in front of students with my mouth open like this, I am thinking about him in a ratty towel saying nothing on the phone, watching TV and smoking one endless cigarette. He doesn't even cough. It enrages me. I hold it in. I can't stop coughing. I swear it's because of him and the emotional duress his depression and distance caused me that I develop certain unpleasant sores about the lip and in my oral cavity, inside my mouth. It makes me feel ugly. It makes me feel ugly, I say. I say, kiss me. He changes the channel. He puts on a shirt. It's a green shirt, a sort of lime green shirt. I like that shirt. I ask him if he likes my body. This is a little poem called Percocet. One of my favorite things. Number one. In the last moment of the Bill of Rights, for 2 hours, I was made of cream. In the distance, a shimmering sweat. Now more than ever, I'm aware of living here. Two. I love when the suckerfish sucks on the astronaut. I love when the suckerfish sucks on the moon. When my phantom jet is sleeping, my phantom jet is fighting. A bright and dreamless sleep in a high gravity place. This is called Holy Week. It explores my difficult relationship with dogs and other creatures. Once I woke up with three of them on me, two holding my arms, the third, their captain, had its snout in my face. I can still hear its breathing, which was when loneliness entered my body. When I woke again, they were gone. The mountains were deeply mislabeled in sun. A human child stood over me, holding a small blood-flecked stone. I returned to the cantina, which was not a cantina, but merely a window onto the street where I stood, or where I had stood. Oh, darkness mine, etc., I prayed. And then darkness fell directly from the air. Next morning, the town was in plain fiesta. A man, one human man, made a symbol with his rubber hands. He was symbolizing me. Together we stood in the plaza over the ashes where Judas Iscariot had been exploded in the plaza. All that was left was his head. Instead of a head, he had a striped plastic ball. Instead of a face, he had two dots and a mouth. The next day was Sunday. When I woke, the Lord was already risen. The pigs next door are eating a shoe or some other kind of human face. Who will there be to forgive them when I die? Monday I left town on the back of a truck, blowing bloody snot into the back of my hat, dawn blasting the high plains with the cold damage of light forever. So this next poem also is about animals. It's a Discovery Channel sort of poem. It's called Woe to the Wildebeest Whose Flesh is to be Torn. Because that's what happens. They are not horses. They are large and shaggy scholars. Sometimes they look dignified and great. Their voice is the voice of certain frogs, a species of enormous croaking. Wildebeest, exact and sober wildebeest. Defrocked Franciscans, they roam the plains, teaching the grasses to sing and to ejaculate. They are not hyenas, they are wild dogs. Beneath the surface of the plains, they hunt cocaine and the elusive wildebeest. In their features, we see the features of other creatures. The downy woodpecker, the humpbacked whale. The wildebeest ejaculate. They're heavy-headed mammals, and it makes them sad. It makes them hang their heads, which gives them a formal air during lectures and group discussions. Their stamping and their waste discipline and rejuvenate the grass. It's been years since the gods took away their pants. They are not badgers. They are wild dogs. They are great kissers and experts. They are specialists in refrigeration. At night, they burrow beneath the plains in the fevered hunt of fresh cocaine. At dawn, they seek the wildebeest. Let's see. We'll continue along the same theme, which seems to be violence. This poem is called Arthur Rimbaud, though I don't know why, except for perhaps I apparently want to fight him personally. I don't know. Last night I dreamt of the parkway again. The senators silent, dignified, sad. The sky blue as the eyes of the beast. I ripped off his ear and part of his face. After the accident, he began to smell different. Not badly, exactly. He began to smell sweet. I wrote a letter explaining my motives. I lined up each pill on the mantle by color. The lines are cut, the shades are drawn. Our bodies are factories factoring light. Our bodies were factories delivering light. I was wearing a raincoat and red leather pants. In the sky, the city had been detained. I was locked in the bathroom, spitting up foam. Later, I helped him search the lawn for his teeth. The whole sky was a flag, blue and horribly still. Let's see. This poem is called Robert Stone, for the author Robert Stone. The pure products of America love math and radiance, want a real relationship with divine substance, and are all criminals. The head of Rubén Darío is not their toy. It is only half boiled. Fever plus gin equals fever. Translucent North American law networks vanish at the edge of your fever. You are an agent. In your photo, the edges of your photo are burning. These are your objectives. One, expansion. Two, reduction. And three, more fever. Put your hand on the glowing salt on the surface of the desert. Put your face on the glowing desert of salt. Here, where a waste of cinders slopes down, the absence of mercy is terrific. There's two more here. And this is called To the American Poets. Colonel, while a captain, you became my father in a radiant field. Gentle evening, biblical and imported from Peru. You touched my father's dappled edge, you made my father dappled. And the deer at the edge of evening, these are French, translucent deer. Dear evening, you make me think of them, these deer and science. And those dogs, dead dogs, murdered dogs in plastic bags. I'm talking about torture in the Republic of Vermont. Dear evening, gentle torture, I'm talking about youth. My youth in radiance near the Academy of Torture. A field of cheese. Dear evening, you are a field of cheese. I have seen your heart beating. Your heart is dark and beating. And at the center of each torture, the forest stays cool and wet. O colonels of the forest of the American school of torture. I have seen these colonels' people. I have seen these people sleep. And the frothing fronds of an uncountable fern. Everything has been seen large through the eyes of my horse. one more poem. This is called Moon Garden. I have many poems called Moon Garden. This one's called Moon Garden or November. On the eve of the wedding, the witch arrived in this city. The great lawn plunged into dark and silent pleasure. In the public forest, a man entered the body of a stranger. When it happened, his eyes were closed. His right hand blooms in cold November. Night cars are converted into light. In the distance, recorded sounds of ventilation and the sea. There is no damage to the liquid. While you sleep, the earth leaks cold traffic onto the street. And the city? What did the city do? It made happiness and codes in the windows underground. I left my voice inside your body when I drowned. Thanks.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you.
So, okay, next we have up Amarnath Rava, who we actually went to school with, and who's going to be reading, I believe, from American Canyon, a book that he's finished recently. Yeah, finished. Yeah. All right. So, welcome, Amar, please.
Welcome.
So yeah, this is just a short section from the manuscript that I'm finished with. I'm not really, but it doesn't matter. I listened to the rain as it fell midday that August. I slept next to my grandfather, who reeked of Chivas Regal whiskey and 555 cigarettes. Tate had very little hair on his body, which he prided himself on, saying in his animated hours that he had baby soft skin. The bus honked its way out of the city through rural stops, through towns with white plastered temples, through streets lined with fruit cars and hot burning corn. The bus played chicken with other buses on one-lane highways in the heart of Andhra. It was packed after an hour of this. A baby perched on the haunch of a woman standing next to my seat, pissed all over my shoes and legs, and the mother insisting that I should sit in my mother's lap because I was young enough. 12 hours later, we crested the hills down into Markapur, past the reservoir and into the main center where Tate greeted us through the window and took us home. When I opened my eyes, I heard wet clothes tied and lifted behind a woman's head and slapped dry against a rock outside. A rickshaw with a bullhorn pedaled by, announcing the latest movie, one with Sri Devi and Kamal Hassan. Everything was audible because Tate's house is over a sari store on the main street, full of stray dogs and dust clouds from passing trucks. A foot-pedaled sewing machine of a tailor whirred at the foot of the stairs when I had gotten up above the noise on the roof where I slept. From there, you can stare at the blue to black sky through the mesh of the mosquito net over your bed at night. When I came down from the roof to go to the outhouse, I passed my grandmother, Amama, sifting rice for dinner to get the rocks out. Nearby was a pile of cooked rice from the night before being picked up by blackbirds. My grandmother was young. At the age of 13, she married T. Chennakesavlu when he was 24. T. Chennakesavlu, or Tataya, was the surviving son of 17. All his brothers and sisters died before they were seven. His father had bought all the land on the main street and watched the value of the land go up as it became the business section of town. In Tate's house, the only thing left of his father is an iron blue safe the size of a fridge and a picture of him, one eye covered by a black patch with a garland of flowers. I liked to pull on Tate's ears, elephant ears, and he told me that there were rabbits inside his stomach and you had to feed them, which is why he drank so much. When Tate was out at the club in his see-through shirt, the smell of cards in the air, I looked at the India Times magazine, the only one in English. Usually he ran out of cigarettes. He would tell me to come over, pull out a 10-rupee note, brown with Ashoka pillars on one side and a Bengal tiger on the other, and tell me to get a pack of gold flakes, or sometimes 555 said like 555s. The other gamblers, each with their Ray-Ban-style glasses and graying facial hair, claimed Tate had built the club. Tate would come home from the club with fireworks hidden behind his back to surprise me with while I was looking through the pictures of him carrying a gun in the jungles of Sri Salem. He used to hunt tigers, played a good game of chess, and was a state tennis champion when he was young. I would take the fireworks up to the roof to blow out of bottles, watching the clouds burst with their stars. All the kids in the neighborhood would hear the whistle of the rockets crack the air and hop from one roof to the next until they reached mine and then stand around, laughing and taking their turns. I woke up one night to the sound of a woman screaming outside across the street. In the shapes, I could recognize her sitting down with her foot stretched out and men saying that a black scorpion had stung her. I remembered how my uncle used to crunch the ones that slept in the middle of the pavement under his boot when we walked home at night from the matinee. When Tate would come home for his midday nap, he would pull out a matchbox with a lotus flower on the front and place it against the wall, quickly opening the box to release a little white scorpion. It would run in frightening circles around the room, moving around from one wall to another until it came back to the place it began. He said that it could kill a grown man, but this one had its stinger cut off. When I wasn't looking, he would grin and form his fingers into a scorpion stinger, placing his pinky over his index finger and then both over his middle finger, reach over and sting me. When he finished his Shivas Regal, he dropped the match in the bottle to show the flame ball up inside. My mother hit her head and said Nakarma, which means my fate. It happened when I was watching the Discovery Channel and she was frying samosas. What do you mean, I asked. When she was at a loss for the right word or tired or had doubts about her son, she spoke in Telugu. The burden of what lay between us would become mine. The samosas were almost ready. I entered the kitchen and listened to what she said. Behind me, a bald eagle fed her young on a cliff somewhere in America. You know, your Tate was a fool. He never worked a day in his life. And look at us now. All of us have to work hard. All he did was gamble away his money. And when he needed to pay for something, like putting his kids through school, he sold the house. Now look, he has nothing, not even his own house. He's been renting that for a year now. A couple of years ago, he took all the money he had left and built the only 3-star hotel in Markapur. It cost him 20 lakhs. Yesterday, Mama called and said that Tate got really drunk with his partner, someone he trusted, and had him sign a paper saying that it was a government document for the hotel to keep it under regulations. It turned out that your grandfather had signed away the whole hotel to this man. 20 lakhs. Now he has nothing. But when his father died, there were bad omens. It is a custom to put rice outside overnight as an offering to your father's spirit to make sure that his soul is content. The blackbirds never ate the rice. They didn't even touch it. Thank you.
And next up is Guy and... come on up.
yes, please.
All right, I brought some LA poems to read, figuring that it seemed appropriate. does that need to go up a little bit? Okay. So these are called 8 architectural miniatures for Igor Stravinsky. 20858 Pacific Coast Highway. This oceanside defined brutalist balance traffic blasts, rhythms its bays with motor access pediments light, an infilled level sandstone wall of glass blocks touching the antiquity fine shoreline grid high as the sea, an armature glazing spaces flow linked by light. 455 Upper Mesa Road. A hill-wide view block's tower connects this home's steeply sloping site to monolithic sprawls, elegantly understated, elevation-shaped volumes, cladding plasterwood, copper, and zinc-coated layouts, bedrooms bottom, as loft spaces curve to terrace two-room masters. 909 25th Street. The barrel-vaulted volume hearts the bougainvillea, grape, wisteria, and trumpet run above the house. From the sun square skewed axis the street looks over to the studio's open green stucco trellising visual presence twist breaks as bands of compact color space That's 909 25th Street. The barrel vaulted volume hearts the bougainvillea, grape, wisteria, and trumpet run above the house. From the sun square skewed access, the street looks over to the studio's open green stucco trellising visual presence twist breaks as bands of compact color space the lot lathe light shaft streaming between the project's great gardens. 1955 and a half Purdue Avenue. Earthquake pulses design striking buildings, absorbing devices, base isolator cylinder within viscous substances, smaller units, energy efficiency panels, and clad the floors and walls, steel frames enclose, inside faces exposed, visible interior. 5905 Wilshire Boulevard. This pavilion exuberant idiosyncratic orientalism structures curving tower-clad aggregate bridges the stairs elevator as columns triangle bowed box beams suspended from cable pale green stucco curves organic walls evoke, paneling angles that face the softly lit space a quiet rape snakes. 8687 Melrose Avenue. Built blue to house bright forms, scale the surrounding aroused float-altered extension to contrasting fragments, symmetrical green spandrels rotate away via a plinth the skylit atrium cylindrical hinge curves wedge in red glass phases this plaza poured in place. 940 North Mansfield. This sandwiched cement works west towering glimpse treasure troves props, offering unexpected truss eruptions of building-filled blue-curved structures shape-scattered detritus make sense of as complex sound lounges, casting vaults, exposed workspaces, bridges, stair-cross from place to place. 1641 Woods Drive. Floating the city this house captures, 180 cave-like, completely glazed views transform the steel-studded, sun-clad panels that glow night like space-enclosing, frameless spiral climbs the mezzanine deck transluses from the copper-dropped ceiling. Thank you.
So next we have Will Alexander, a great poet from Los Angeles, of course.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Come on up.
It's the end of a long day, so I'll read a couple parts here. This is a poem I just started reading, actually, for the first time last week, so I'll get some more work with it tonight. It's called Concerning Forms Which Hold Heidegger in Judgment. In a flawed Slovakian brick house, Dasein strange to purge from its forms, rulership, pogroms, feces. It seeks general absolution for its crimes as consultant, for its mirage as a man of just causes. It views from its window ironic brimstone snow, muted conniving intangibles, and philosophy an exploded circular elf, a thoughtless sodium concentration. Being in the world circuitously tainted by useless Himmlers, by Ernst Jünger and his brigades from brigades expressive of Dachau. It is 1962, it is 1947, and it silently endures a mirage of throttled gypsies, a stony rat's embankment sculpted by sullen Polish teeth. And so how can Dasein submit expression to fiery flesh entombed, to ironic flights of Holderlin, to the sun blown away by contraction? It meanders like a rat across its minimal treaty with verbs, across a treaty monitored by guises of vomit. It seeks to summon its furnace with off-white cadavers with minted cerulean remains. It is menaced by some as subjective grief, by defeated monarchs as lead. Then life arrives as neurological engulfment, as tariff, as plotting impasse vacuum. Its body polluted hailstone riddles, as shattered morality, as shattered flashback spectrum, the true imposture as carcass. One thinks of galactic sand somberly sifted in a haunted Lutheran bottle. Then the rectorship lecture, and the quoting of the spirit by general mockery as journey, by debut at the gate of sickened thinking intensity, or Dasein as ice in a darkened migratory vein of its open being across evacuated vacuums. And so the corpses mount for Dasein Martin. The mimetic Aristotelian motives brought back across the eye as dangerous skeletal kinetics under the guise of eclectic bartering gnomes. Martin, I'm claiming you as leader by acidic incapacity, by megalomania as ejected misnomer. Not indictment as ex post factum construction, but thought as eviscerated misnomer, as stalled judgmental breakage. Martin, the wind then ignites disjointed geometries, then the ghosts fly in from the waves. They are ancient and composed of higher bodiless bodies, of nerves that descend to territorial panic. So I think of waiting pincers, of moons in the death gas, of claustrophobic beguilement as Richter. The grammar of such German-speaking voice scarred by hardened carrion plums, by diabolical largesse, by the chemical sediments from war. For instance, a seized opal, a seismological burin, a diacritical ammonia. At Freiburg, Dasein open to the strong desolation of ale, to mental properties conceived in an alcoholic law court. By lapse in the stony circle of crisis, you exude basic codes of crime, condoned by elusive electrical cancer, perhaps a triggered ontology as meteorite, as a strange cephalic scaffolding perch, camouflaged at times by the powers of Parmenides and Nietzsche. Beneath your silence, beneath your stony implosives, I invade your deeper storm concerning elusives, concerning cranial gain and emotion. I'll read one more here. I guess we'll work in this part of the world tonight. And I'll read one more from a book that's been waiting for some time to be published. And it will be published. But this is a poem, that is, the book will be published. This is a poem from the book. The book's Impulse and Nothingness, and Green Energy's going to release it. But this is a poem about Albania. And I was sitting in my library one afternoon, and the rays of the sun were hitting at a strange angle, and I was looking at this book. And I had stacks of these National Geographics, and you're just in this daze, just going through things, you know, page, boom, Albania. And something just hit me, you know, about Albania. And I know that the filmmaker, Herzog, took a walking tour through Albania at one time, just walked across the border, and nothing happened. So I said, well, since he can walk across the border, I can at least psychically flow through the border. And so this is a poem, it's just called Albania and the Death of Enver Hoxha. And by the way, Hoxha, if you don't know him, ruled Albania from the end of the Second World War to basically our times, you know, about 1975. So he was there a long time, and they're still dealing with the residue. So I feel it's current. This is the last piece, so read. Albania and the Death of Enver Hoxha. Sacrifice, closely paralleled with sadness, with darkened lunar wounds in the brain, the thoughts laced with paralysis ciphers, the voice full of fumaroles and muffled X-ray voltage, the cells cold with exhaustive inversion. And so all pronouncements become tautological, derisive. Each attempt at revival sundered with a weary, dysfunctional torment with psychic nuclear crippling and hyperborean chills. All attempts at recovering push back into limbo. If one could look at the soul, it would take on the grief of a savagely splintered darkness, a simile of cacti and arrowheads burrowing into the crucially exposed eye stalks of crustaceans, the face always stained by a ruthless sabulosity coupled by paranoia and blasting. The expiring Enver Hoxha prone like a skull on a slab of Marxist invectives, with a glut of crushed worms slipping from his forehead, laying there with personal rabies on the breath. An ignited grandeur coming out in riddles of oracular demon pulleys, rust burns smoking below the stones of his flesh, his dictatorial mutterings like a spurt of unseasonable frog gills, like a grotesque insecticidal frenzy calling out from tormented histamine gardens, calling out from decrepit Dodonas diseased with insidious meiosis. Hoxha, with secretive bone grafts, with rational murdering solutions, always hardened like blackened myasthenias. All his rebellious hirelings slaughtered in a square by machine gun and mortar, the killers surreptitiously empowered by mutative alienation, by a heart of stunted mangrove blisters, and his dreams like a definition of mustard gas, irritating, blistering, disabling. Hoxha sucking in fumes from his after-death exposure, his astral obliteration like an exquisite brew of heinous polonium cocktails, full of disintegrated polyhymnias, full of mental pollution and polymorphic pariahs and sweating, full of stunted radium volcanoes and the sociology of crows. In a Stygian neurosis, this demon atop asphyxiation and thrones always remains demasted, and haunted wallowing aspersions of asynchronous assuagement. His lost Palmygian body directing his troops across a coldly burning land with all the embraceable contusions of a stifling necrology. Report to his majesty that the bones have been crushed, that the spleens are now rotted, that all is in order. The sun, like an Albanian nothingness, like an exposed nerve of singing, suddenly turned over into neutralized materia and banished as a dried pineal concentration. And here we have Enver Hoxha on his deathbed, breathing in parasites and noxious Arabian vesications, breathing in malodorous tubularian rains, the remaining pores of his body filled with a furious obturation, with a dense clinical stoppage, taking a poll of his highly conducive death counts. His obverse vivisectionist commandments, it's the population an arrested quotient, a blank but undivided numerical dogma, wrestling with desires in molded sparring chambers, burning and Stalinist dialectical hells. And so Hoxha, with his convinced insolutional ravings, speaking out with his oily wolverine's tongue, wrapped in his popular grave clothes of blackness. There were days when the moon began to howl at high noon, when all the aromas were suspended, when all the corpses were dredged up and eaten, when each anniversary of living was marked by insidious facial scarring, by vicious dog bites on the buttocks. This was reason. And so the populace, full of carcinoma and rugas, their eyes cast down into sarsodotal infernos, into cold, intensive lesion mining, could only witness their faces in puddles of urine, could only imagine how a morning of restive balneology would feel, how a life of campanology could brighten the darkness, but always disaster, gray, and permitted to burn like a daily burden of calcinated litmus, like a corpse with a vertebrae of flukes tossed up from the Adriatic shallows, tossed up in its ashen, lonely demeanor as an isolated cargo of worms. And Hoxha, quoting remnants of Engels concerning motion and divisibility, kinetics and bodies under his Spartan flag of pickaxe and rifle. The horseless carriage banned, the blood supply diminished, the hillsides a jagged line of misty peaks, like horizontal shards, like gigantic electrocardiograms, more occluded than Tibet, creeping along the boulevard of fallen heroes, where one can feel the peasants feeding on grasses, seeking to mobilize their anomalous wrath to production. The cities full of windowless walls and the heritage of blood feuds. Yes, Albania like a blackened, double-headed eagle on a coursing field of blood. Its exteriorized sacrifice ministries, its ferocious injury battalions, its cold atheistic medallions charged with a charisma and spite. Like a premise or a scar, or a pure line of rote from its separating memory, its mosques turned into stables, comets and asteroids banished from the language, and so one is given to mechanics, the interchange of motion and equilibrium, and the measurable transference of motion. The quantitative expression, the hatred of alien morality. And so Hoxha, purged of all animal sentiment, his deathbed like a broken imperial rock seething with a secretive personal dissension. Even the directorate of agitation is crumbling in his vistas because he smells the insurrectional molecules of the infinite blowing into his itinerant pantomime chamber. The inscrutable Hadean depths, a group of denuded chromium puppets floating before his eyes. His bizarre self-palpable plainness thrown into the face of cosmic betrayal, ulcerations and demons appear beside his visage. Even his own skull appears on the plainly colored revetment. And the sun, once simply a mechanical furnace, is now a thrust of light burning up his bones in the bulging knot of old foxtrots and purges. Thank you.
Okay, I'm back. Next up is Ara Sharanian. And Ara was our first LA Lit guest, giving us the test.
Yeah, it's funny because the interview I recorded with Ara was going to be like a demo. We were just going to try it out. But then it was such a good interview that it became the first LA Lit show. So welcome, Ara. Yeah, thanks, man.
Sorry I came so late. I don't know what this one's called. It's the newest thing I'm working on. But it's the description of every Alfred Jarry used book on just the description of the quality of the book on abooks.com. I'm not going to read everything. There's about 1,300. Just a little bit. You can see it's very sensual. You know, it's, you know, the people, some of the bookstore owners really, really feel these books up. And the way they write about them is very, very, you'll see. Minimal X library processing appears that front wrapper was detached at one time. Major clear library tape repair to spine now faded. Light fading edges and wrappers. Bit of light soiling, including faint impression of water. Glass rear wrapper, very light. Toning of text pages, few instances of light creasing and soiling. Noted on a few pages, trade paperback original, very good and in good wraps. Some slight rubbing on top of spine. Cover shows age, is worn along spine. Clear layer is peeling on spine. Front bottom corner has fold, corners curling slightly. Pages yellowing. Previous owners, info, front fold, text clean, in French. Book is in very good condition, standard used condition. This soft cover is in good condition. No rips or markings or stains. Mass market paperback in French, has remainder mark on bottom edge, but looks near new otherwise. Clean, good sturdy binding, 2-inch coffee stain on bottom of text block, no other writing, stamps or marks noted, a decent once read copy with no inscriptions, a good lightly used copy. This book is brand new and unread, may have very minimal edge rubbing. Book is in used condition, chipped edges, marginalia, several creased corners to pages, may contain remainder marks, good to very good condition with small mark on edge, clean and bright with light foxing on rear, very light wear, innards clean and tight with comment on first title, light browning and scuffing to covers, boat shows general light wear with a bump to spine, foxed pages, and previous owner name to flyleaf, paperback in near new condition except for faint discoloration through age, unread, no jacket, book in acceptable use condition, chipped edges, marginalia, highlighting, unknown binding, book condition, good, second printing, item has several minor flaws or a significant flaw, such as writing in the text, light wear and faint browning to spine, and wraps, ink name on front wrap, ink notes on title page, ink underlines to introduction. Book is in excellent condition, very minor wear on cover. All else is excellent. Interior appears very gently read, if at all. Good, cheap, worn re-reading copy. Creased spine, soiling to wraps, text block, beginning to separate, some creasing, slight soiling to laminated wraps, light foxing to edges, previously read, moderate to light wear, corner curling on the back, cover bottom, some soiling to the bottom edge, incline on page 14 to the side of the text, soft cover, good light wear front, cover corner bent different cover, then shown, soft cover, book condition, near fine, remainder mark, rubbing, edge wear, tight, clean, unread, copy, some wear around edges, text clean and unmarked, packaged, carefully sent same day with free tracking, rubbing no corners, browning and wear to wrap edges, light general wear, but a nice clean tight book, fast shipping, binding is paperback, book condition good, dust jacket condition, no dust jacket. Brand new, never opened, right hand edge of book cover slightly discolored, slight yellowing at edges of pages, paperback, ex-library, with usual stamps and markings, in fair condition, suitable as a study copy. The page edges are slightly marked, and there is very unobtrusive wear to the back cover, but the text is clean, and the binding is tight. Paperback, spine faded, light yellowing, very good soft cover, odd photo of a fat man on cover, underscoring and or marginalia through page 134 of 532. After that, no markings. Spine and cover very good. Glossy pictorial, mass market size paperback. Near fine with no defects. Worth noting. Paperback with minor wear to wraps. Clean and tight. American poet Ray DePalma's copy. With his name on front fold. Book browned and rubbed. Book coming loose. Front cover. Pages toning. A couple underlined. Spots. Else clean. Serious whack-ass shit. A real nice copy, written in French text. One tiny crease on back panel. The usual acidic paper browning. A clean, tight copy. Very well-preserved copy, despite some fading. Soft cover, cheaply made, and pages are heavily browned, but usable. New, unread, not a remainder, and written completely in French. The pristine text block of this as-new market. Paperback is entirely clean, tight, square, and carries no highlighting, underlining, or marginalia. The pictorial covers are entirely clean, bright, uncreased, and show only the most minor edge and corner bumping. Moderate dust jacket wear, scuffed, discolored, and clipped. Writing inside cover, binding is tight. Moderate cover wear, some age. Thanks.
So we just wanted to give you all a big, huge, 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 huge thank you for being here and for having been on the show in the past and for being writers.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for everyone that's been on LA Lit in the last year and everyone that will be on LA Lit in the future. And thank you for everyone that's here and everyone that's read. And just thank you also for generally creating like a... itself some kind of like strange literary connection, community, blah blah blah. It's fabulous.
Some whack ass shit.
Cheers.
Thank you guys for doing